About 2,400 Illinoisans are on electronic monitoring as a condition of their release from prison. But some say these ankle monitors actually make it harder to re-enter society. Plus, we'll learn about the world's fastest supercomputer. It's going to be built at Argonne National Labs with help from the Department of Energy. And a new play at the Goodman Theater in Chicago takes on the decline of manufacturing jobs and tells a very personal story of its consequences.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks to Brian Mackey for filling in for me last week. Coming up later this hour, Argonne National Laboratories will soon be home to the world's fastest supercomputer. And we hear about factories and manufacturing jobs being lost all the time. But this story is being told in a new way at Chicago's Goodman Theater through the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Sweat. Its director joins us. But first, over the past few years, more than 600,000 people in America have been released from prison each year. And before they're fully released, many have to fulfill the conditions of their mandatory supervised release, more commonly known as parole. And for nearly 2,400 people in Illinois, parole comes with an electronic monitor. That's usually a device that's strapped to someone's ankle and tracks their location. Advocates, including people who've been on electronic monitoring themselves, say these monitors actually make it more difficult to re-enter society. And they're pushing for legislation to overhaul the state's EM program. We're going to hear more about that bill from State Representative Carol Ammons in just a moment. But first, I wanted to welcome Augie Torres to the 21st. He lives and works in Chicago and was on electronic monitoring for 60 days after he was released from prison. He's one of the advocates calling for a change to the system. Hi, Augie. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Augie, I wanted to start by going back to the days right after you were released. You had been incarcerated for 20 years. I'm sure there was a lot going through your mind as you were got out. Did you think about how much electronic monitoring meant when you were released that didn't mean that you were necessarily free?
Actually, yes, I did. I was already aware that electronic monitoring had been in use already for quite some time in Illinois, and that I had pretty much almost like 100% chance of receiving it upon release from once I completed my sentence. So it was something that I was definitely apprehensive about, just not understanding how much it was going to affect my everyday life and my ability to reintegrate back into society to begin that process of finding employment and receiving any kind of identifications or any other kind of services that I would need in order to get back on track.
Augie, I do want to get to some of the apprehension you had, but first I just wanted to ask you, why, do you know why or were you told why you had to have one of these ankle monitoring bracelets when you were released?
Actually, we were not told. It was, you know, something that was just happening, and you know, everybody on the inside was never really given a good understanding as to why this was taking place. You know, years after, I understood that the reason was being that policymakers felt that it would reduce recidivism rates amongst people returning back to society, and that it would also improve public safety. But there's no definitive data that shows that that has taken place.
But did they tell you why you specifically needed one?
No, it's a process where everybody is assessed in a way. You sit down with a representative of the Prisoner Review Board for maybe about 5-10 minutes, and they kind of go through your file, and then they end up making a decision, and you get that decision via mail. So you never really get a good understanding as to why it is that you receive that amount of time on electronic monitoring, and no real answer as to why you get the specific amount of time as well.
And so you had 60 days. What was that like in terms of what conditions did you have to fulfill as part of your parole while you had the electronic monitoring in place?
So the main thing was that I was pretty much bound to my home unless I had explicit permission to leave the house. So initially, the parole officer gave me 3 days a week where I could leave the house, and the time was from 9 to 4 o'clock. So I had a few hours to find employment, make it to job interviews, and get back home before that time expired. So the time was very limited, and it wasn't it definitely wasn't conducive to helping me find employment.
And what happens if you are not home in time when they give you those boundaries? What happens?
Sure. So if you don't make it home on time before your time expires, you could be sent back to prison. And you would be sent back immediately that day, and you would be back at the exact same prison you came from, wearing the exact same clothes you were wearing when they picked you up. So you would not go to the county. You would not receive additional charges. It would just simply violate your conditions of MSR, mandatory supervised release, and would land you directly back in the exact same prison you paroled from.
And so, Augie, I imagine that obviously, understandably, made you nervous about not wanting to break that. How did you balance that with trying to find a job? Were there times that that interfered, that you weren't able to get an interview? They were asking you to interview outside of those 3 days a week and 9 to 4 restrictions that your parole officer had put on you?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, the when I first came home, I was looking for employment, so I cast my net as widely as possible. I wasn't really being picky as to what opportunities I was looking for. So I applied to a lot of different non-for-profits and also applied to a lot of different places such as restaurants and places of business where that would have employment for just minimum wage job, anything that would just get the ball rolling as far as just beginning to earn an income. So a lot of those places that would call me, the restaurants and warehouses that would call me the day of or the night before, and that would ask me if I could come in for an interview. And most of the time, that actually ended up being on Mondays. And Mondays was, I mean, excuse me, like on Tuesday or Wednesday, and those were the days that I did not have movement from my parole officer. So it became a thing where I felt that I had to tell the employer that I could make it the following morning to the interview. But I was doing that knowing that I had to be able to get a hold of my parole officer and get permission from them before I could actually step outside of the house at
And did
7
that
or 6 o'clock
happen?
in the
Was that
morning.
hard to
Actually,
do?
that was actually, it never did happen. I never was able to get a hold of my parole officer on time to be able to leave for those interviews. And it's because, they are busy. They have a huge caseloads, but at the same time, they're not able to get to each one of the phone calls that are being left in the voicemail. So, I would get a phone call from my parole officer usually in the afternoon, or sometimes in the evening. And, they would tell me, yeah, sorry, I missed your call. And, maybe next time you'll be able to get a hold of me a little bit quicker. But yeah, I was not able to do that, and I ended up actually losing hope of finding employment during that first month. And I gave up my job search, and I decided to just go ahead and do the duration of the 60 days without employment, and just begin that process again once I was off the monitor.
That's Augie Torres, and we're talking to him about electronic monitoring. And we met Augie through Lee Gaines, who's a reporter with the Illinois Newsroom, a statewide collaboration of public radio stations. Lee is based at WILL in Urbana, and she's in studio with me now. Hi, Lee. Welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
So, Lee, as we're hearing Augie describe this situation, can you just tell us a little bit about electronic monitoring? How does this, why this was situated, first of all, why this was put in place originally?
Well, Augie's correct. I think a lot of the philosophy around EM is about this idea that it's going to reduce recidivism. To address that point directly, the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority actually had a judicial hearing on the subject of EM last month, said that there's no definitive conclusions that this does actually reduce recidivism rates for people who are on it. There's some evidence that maybe for some high-risk populations, sex offenders being one of them, that it could, but there's really a lack of rigorous study around this topic.
And so the whole idea of this is not just recidivism, but I guess also crime prevention. That's also part of it.
Yes. The chair of the Prisoner Review Board, Craig Findlay, he did say that he believed that this was a beneficial thing for some people, especially those people coming out of prison after very long sentences, that this provided some structure in their lives.
Augie, did you feel that way?
In a way, it did. I mean, as far as like having set boundaries and limitations to what you can and can't do, if you consider that structure, yes, it falls under that definition. But structure as far as just helping me better understand and navigate the world that I was now, again, part of, it did not, absolutely not help in any way whatsoever in that form.
Yeah, it sounds like it also created like another layer of obstacles, especially when we're thinking about employment. So we're speaking with Augie Torres, who was on electronic monitoring for 60 days after his release from prison, and Lee Gaines. And I want to welcome a few more folks into this conversation. Representative Carol Ammons is in studio with us as well in Urbana. She's a Democrat. She represents Champaign-Urbana in the General Assembly in Illinois' 103rd District. Representative Ammons, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And James Kilgore is also with us. He's one of these advocates we were talking about. He's the director of the Challenging E-Carceration Project. He's also in studio with us here in Urbana. Thanks for being here as well, James.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, Representative Ammons, James, can I just ask you, as we're hearing Augie share his story, how many times you all have heard stories like this in the past of folks who were formerly incarcerated, have this electronic monitoring, and how much this is in some ways a hindrance to them getting employment after they've been released?
I'll just say that about almost 2 years ago, I started getting information from some research that James was doing with another project. And I began to just read the articles that they were submitting, and I realized this is a huge problem. So I reached out to the Department of Corrections and began having phone conferences with them around ways that we can address electronic monitoring in Illinois and to figure out who was in charge of this and why was this happening. Through those conversations, the stories became more prevalent. People began to inform me of their lack of employment because they can't move, or incidents that are really severe incidents around medical emergencies that prevent people from getting treatment because they can't get a hold of this person who's supposed to give them permission to move. And these are severe situations that really need immediate attention. And unfortunately, they can't get a hold of anyone to get movement. And so some people have been violated, as they call it, meaning returned to the Department of Corrections, as a result of things that you and I would find to be reasonable expectations.
Like an ambulance coming to their house?
Absolutely.
And that
reasonable.
Has
that has happened. Or family members driving their loved one to an emergency room visit because they can't get a hold of a parole officer in this case, because that person may have been severely injured. These have been stories that we've heard over the last 2 years, along with the research that Mr. Kilgore has done across this broad topic, because there's many forms of EM in use. But what we saw was those who have completed their sentences, really, there's no real data about public safety or the necessity thereof for them to be on electronic monitoring. And it's just costing the state a lot of money.
James, can you just share a little bit about your research in terms of, first of all, also I want to ask you a follow-up with what Carol Ammons said, Representative Ammons said, about how there are different forms of electronic monitoring that happens, not just these ankle bracelets?
Sure. My research really grows out of my own experience of spending a year on electronic monitoring after incarceration, and that was way back in 2009, 2010, but I began to encounter some of those problems, and then over the course of the years, I've spoken to dozens and dozens of people, and the stories are similar to Augie's. They're similar to what Representative Ammons has said, but also there's the technology, the capacity of this technology is greatly increasing. So 10 years ago, most of the devices simply told the authorities if you were at home or not. Now, most of them have GPS capacity, meaning that they're tracking your every movement and they're logging it, and it's being stored on a cloud somewhere. And to be quite honest, in most cases, we don't know what happens to that data, but we have a pretty good idea that somehow it's getting monetized, like most of the data that we have. And as people become more and more used to Fitbits and other kinds of devices that respond to biometrics, we're concerned that this is going to become part of the tracking devices that are used by the departments of corrections and local authorities across the country.
And so what about the, to Representative Ammon's point, the public safety aspect of this? I mean, is there research into whether or not this makes a difference with folks who have been incarcerated in terms of committing crimes?
I've been doing research on this for about 8 years. And there really is no definitive research anywhere in this country that shows that electronic monitoring has a positive impact on recidivism or public safety. And I think also part of that narrative is defining public safety in a way that's constructed by law enforcement. But for most of us who are coming out of prison, public safety means being secure. That is, having access to health care, having access to employment, and being able to be part of a community and a family in order to for you to keep your life back on track. And those are the things that are going to keep you away from even considering becoming involved in crime again if that's what you did in the past. So we need to rethink what we mean by public safety and think of it in a much broader context.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with James Kilgore, with Representative Carol Ammons, with Lee Gantz, and with Augie Torres, who's on the line with us from Chicago. We're also going to hear what IDOC thinks about electronic monitoring. We've got a little bit of audio from them, and I want to hear a little bit more, Representative Ammons, about the bill. I know there's a committee vote on this tomorrow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Stay close. Right after this break, we'll pick up this conversation.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Emphatic, American Painting from the Collection, featuring art by Louise Fishman, Mark Rothko, Purvis Young, and more, on view now through May 12th. More at kam.illinois.edu.
For tuning into The 21st. Right now, we're talking about electronic monitoring systems that are placed on individuals after they've been released from prison. Right now, there are about 2,400 people in Illinois who have these systems. Representative Carol Ammons is in studio with us. She's a Democrat representing Urbana, among other locations in central Illinois. She's got a bill that's actually, there's a vote on tomorrow regarding this. That bill was, one of the advocates was James Kilgore, who's the director of the Challenging E-Carceration Project, along with Augie Torres, who both of them formerly incarcerated, who are now advocating for changes to this system. We know about this story because of reporting from the Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gantz, and we'll tweet out Lee's story on this if you want some more information on this. Lee, can I just ask, who manages? So when we have these electronic monitoring systems, James was just talking about, Augie was sharing his story of reaching out to his parole officer. Is the parole board in charge of this monitoring? Like, how does this work?
So there's two state agencies that are in charge of this, essentially. So there's the Prisoner Review Board Agency, which in its simplest terms decides the conditions for release for individuals. So it's the Prisoner Review Board Agency that decides whether or not someone is on electronic monitoring.
And they're separate from IDOC.
They are separate. They're two separate agencies that communicate with one another. So IDOC can make recommendations to the Prisoner Review Board and say, hey, I think this person should be on EM. And then there's a small subset of offenses that require EM by law. That's primarily sex offenses. But there's plenty of people that can be placed on EM at the discretion of the PRB. I have been trying to find out exactly how many people on EM currently are on, because the PRB decided to put them on.
So when we say electronic monitoring, how many, the prison review board, how do we know how many people are on that at the discretion of the review board versus from a crime that they've committed?
I have not been able to get that answer from the PRB.
Representative Ammons, do you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer because the PRB, it's a little bit cloudy how this works. The PRB has certain statutory requirements that the General Assembly gives as to who should be on electronic monitoring by statute. And then they have this whole group of people, that 2,400, 2,500 people, that they just decide based on whatever they decide to put these additional people on electronic monitoring. And what people really need to understand is that what we're proposing in House Bill 1115 would eliminate the use of electronic monitoring for people who have completed their sentences, meaning prior to the incarceration epidemic that we're experiencing now, prior to that, parole officers would check in with a person who's on parole after they've completed their sentences. They would visit them at home. They would visit them at work or wherever they decided and make sure that they had resources and whatever they need and that they were doing the right thing. Once this became available technology, the caseloads, of course, expanded and the parole officers are not necessarily parole officers the way we think of it in a traditional sense. They put folks on electronic monitoring, and the PRB statement at our hearing in February was pretty amazing to me that they don't have a risk assessment tool that they're referring to in order to determine whether a person should or should not be on it. They are just, based on these one-on-one interviews, as Augie mentioned it, determining this as some outcome. We've not been able to dwindle down what that base decision-making process is.
And so, Representative Ammons, I mentioned there's a vote in the House Judiciary Committee tomorrow afternoon on your bill. What exactly are you proposing then in terms of changing the electronic monitoring system in Illinois?
So basically, the bill would eliminate the use of electronic monitoring for those who have completed their sentences. And I want to say completed their sentences. So those who are using electronic monitoring as a part of their sentence, we're not dealing with those.
So, for example, people who would be early released?
Correct.
Okay, you're not talking about that.
No, we're not talking about those folk. We're talking about those who have completed their sentence according to the Department of Correction and under a traditional model would be released from prison and probably to a halfway house or some other a home setting.
So Augie Torres is still with us. Augie, so in your case, you were put on electronic monitoring after your sentence was finished, correct? You were not part of an early release program?
Yeah, that's correct. I was not part of an early release program. So in effect, it was an extension of my sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important part. What Augie just said is that he completed the years determined by a court that he needed to serve for the crime he committed. And then the PRB decided that they would extend his sentence. And that's problematic. And so what we're trying to do is to say not only to the Department of Corrections that the reformatory actions that I and several of my colleagues lead up, we are looking at not only saving the department the resources that we spend $6 million plus dollars a year for a cohort of people who have completed their sentence. And I don't know how many people listening would like to do more time even after serving whatever time they were required to do.
And you're saying
this
costs
form.
The state $6 million a year?
Average.
On average. Lee, we reached out to both the Illinois Department of Corrections and the Prisoner Review Board. They declined our interview requests to come on the 21st to talk about this. You were able to speak with them. What did they say about this program?
So just to clarify, I didn't speak with them, but they did speak at last month's Judicial Committee hearing about this issue. And they spoke after they heard from a number of people complaining about not being able to go to job interviews, to go to medical appointments. There was one really brutal story of a woman whose uncle had an electronic monitor on his ankle, and he was unable to go to appointments for cancer treatment. He died, and she said that that monitor stayed on his ankle for weeks after he was deceased, and they were unable to lay him to rest. So they came on and gave their testimony after this panel, and they did not vigorously defend their use of electronic monitoring. They actually acknowledged that they needed to reform the program.
And so we have a little bit of that audio, correctly, from the hearing. And who are we going to hear from?
We're going to hear from the assistant director of the Illinois Department of Corrections. Her name is Gladys Taylor.
We're trying to address them. These changes don't occur overnight. We're receptive. I don't think any of us sat here and listened to what was shared with us in panel one with total disagreement. We know we have to make change.
So that's the Assistant Director of the Illinois Department of Corrections, Gladys Taylor, testifying in Springfield on this.
Actually in Chicago.
In Chicago. Okay. Testifying in Chicago on this last month. And so what, in general, are we, in Representative Ammons, can I ask you what the Illinois Department of Corrections has said about, it sounds like there's a public acknowledgement that maybe this system needs to be changed?
We've had, myself and several of my staff members had many conversations with Assistant Director Taylor on this program, even leading up to that hearing. And she, again, acknowledged that the program really needed some reform. What she initially, I think what they talked about during the hearing as well, is that the PRB, the Department of Corrections, has less decision-making authority when it comes to these post-completed returning citizens. They are not making that decision according to the Department of Corrections. That's coming from the PRB. My office has not worked directly with the PRB on this initiative. What the PRB shared at the hearing, though, is that they are pretty clear that they need to institute some changes and they are working on some data collection and so on and so forth. But we believe, though, at this stage, in 2009, there was a law that was passed requiring the same data collection points that they testified to in February of 2019. Hmm. In 2009, we have a bill that changes the law and requires data collection.
And has that happened?
And it has not happened. Not a single item in that bill has been collected since 2009. And here we are at 2019. Really pushing and forcing change in an area that unfortunately they just weren't prepared for. And it really needs to be done at this point.
That's Representative Carol Ammons. There's going to be a vote on her bill that she's talking about tomorrow. James Kilgore, Augie Torres, I just wanted to end by asking both of you just about, I think, James, I just want to come back to what you said about the narrative here and our conversations around when we think about people who have served their time and coming back into society and reentry and this whole issue of public safety. I wonder what you think we're misunderstanding about this situation or maybe not thinking about this correctly.
I think what we're misunderstanding is we're spending $6 million on a technology that punishes people. And we've done some calculations to say that, for example, we could put about 400 people through a year at the University of Illinois for that same money. We could construct about 30 community-based reentry centers across the state where we don't have any reentry services in most small towns and finance those and provide the kinds of opportunities and support services that people need. And that's going to enhance public safety. Not locking people in their houses, not sending them back to prison because the bus delays them and gets them back to their house 10 minutes late. We need to rethink how we're spending the money, because this money is all going to the GEO Group, which is the largest private prison operator in the world. We need to get it into a source that's going to benefit people who are coming out of prison.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. Augie Torres, I want to thank you for joining us along with James Kilgore, Representative Carol Ammons, and Lee Gaines. We will tweet out Lee's stories on this. All of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you good at doing calculations in your head?
Ryan, what is 39,553 plus 2,302?
41,855.
Correct. 39 times 7.
273.
Correct.
Okay, well, that's from one of the fastest human examples of people who are good at doing calculations. That's from the show Child Genius. Of course, most people would just probably Google that or put it into their smartphone. And as fast as Ryan was, if you use the world's fastest supercomputer, you'd have that answer in less than a fraction of a second. To be specific, the world's fastest supercomputer can make a quintillion calculations per second. For those of you keeping track at home, that's a billion calculations every second. And Argonne National Laboratories will soon be home to the world's fastest supercomputer, which has been nicknamed Aurora. Mike Popka is the director of the Argonne Leadership Computing Facility. He's on the line from Argonne to tell us more. Hi, Mark. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Mike, for those of us who are not in the supercomputing world, I'm not sure that we even understand what the idea of a supercomputer is and what it looks like or even how big it is. What does how much space is Aurora going to take up?
Well, that's a good question. So there's really two components to running a supercomputer, and one is the physical machine itself. And from that standpoint, Aurora will be somewhere between a tennis court and two tennis courts in size. So somewhere
that's pretty big. Yeah,
it is pretty big. And it, what really is more interesting, at least from the standpoint of putting it together, is how much has to go on behind the scenes in terms of supporting that. And I would say that's more on the order of four or five tennis courts worth of pumps and electrical switches and transformers that people don't usually see. We don't usually show that to them. It's not doing any calculations. It's not contributing to the science. It's just solely there to support the machine.
And so, Mike, let's talk about the science and the machine. Why, and can you give us examples of why people would need to do as many calculations as Aurora will be able to do per second?
Sure. Well, we want to make the world a better place. We want to understand the world we live in. And so for a long time, people have been doing simulations. They do simulations for a variety of reasons. They do simulations because they can't reproduce it in the real world. And a great example of that is work done in cosmology. We can't recreate the Big Bang in a laboratory, but we can recreate it in a computer. And so that's one end of the spectrum of a very basic science that the supercomputer tries to answer. At the far other end, the applied side, we want to design better airplanes. We want to design better drugs for cancer treatment. And we can do those also in a supercomputer. We can do predictions of how a drug's going to interact with a given cancer cell. We can do a prediction of how the cancer or the drug will work on your specific cancer cell. And so as we move towards Aurora, that increased fidelity, our ability to the more mimic the real world becomes ever increasing. So each time we do a simulation, what we want to do is put in a bunch of equations that dictate how the world behaves.
Right. So all those different variables, right?
Exactly. So every time we get a faster supercomputer, we can add more variables. We can add more physics, more chemistry to make it more realistic.
And when we think about the world's fastest supercomputer, I remember when Blue Waters came to the University of Illinois here in Urbana. I think feel like every year there's a faster supercomputer that keeps getting developed. Why will this project be important even after, I imagine within a year or two, there will be another fastest supercomputer that's out there, right?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we see this, you know, with the home gaming systems too, right? Every year there seems to be a new gaming system. And supercomputers are technology at the edge. Of course, there's a new one every year. And there will be follow-ons to Aurora. But Aurora will still contribute, just like Blue Waters continues to deliver great science for Illinois and for Champaign-Urbana, for the university there. Our machines at Argonne, Mira and Theta, which are our two current biggest machines, Mira has been operated since 2012 and still delivers great science, and same with Theta that came online in 2017. Faster machines will come, but we will still do science on Aurora. We will still be able to tackle the problems that will be, you know, we won't answer them in one day. So we will continue to use it for 4 or 5 years as we actually start planning for the next one.
All right. Well, that's Mike Popka, who's director of the Argonne Leadership Computing Facility. When will Aurora be installed, Mike?
We're doing the electrical work and plumbing work right now. The machine will start to arrive in 2021, And as soon as it arrives and is operational, we'll start computing science. So late 21, early 22, something like that.
That's Mike Popka from Argonne National Labs in Lamont in the Chicago suburbs. Mike, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, I had a chance to sit down with the Goodman Theater director, Ron O.J. Parsons, about a Pulitzer Prize-winning play that's being staged at the Goodman, Sweat. That'll conversation coming up just after the break. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A new play at the Goodman Theater in Chicago explores the very human consequences of what happens when factory workers get replaced. Here's a clip.
It's getting harder and harder to pull myself up and go to work every day.
She tripping.
I hear you. But the trick is you got to find a rhythm and stay inside of it. That's how you manage.
Well, it ain't a rhythm I want to learn.
What, the floor? It ain't good enough for you?
Don't get it twisted. I'm not saying that, but...
what?
You ain't noticed this been going on?
No, what are you talking about?
I don't know, forget it.
No, don't do that. Come on, what?
Like last week. Remember when they had a couple of them white hats walking the floor?
Yeah, so? Dude, they're probably just upgrading the equipment.
Well, they got buttons now. Boop. That can replace all of us. Boop, boop.
Come on, man, you're paranoid.
That's a clip from Lynn Nottage's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Sweat. It alternates between the years 2000 and 2008 and explores many themes, not just race, class, and immigration, but what happens when a Pennsylvania factory town goes out on strike. Sweat arrives in Chicago for the first time at the Goodman Theater. You can see it there until April 14th. I had a chance to sit down with director Ron O.J. Parson recently at the Goodman in Chicago to talk to him more about the play. Ron O.J. Parson,
yes.
Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here with me.
Glad to be here.
This play has, I think it's a really timely topic when we think about, even though this goes back in history a little bit. So this is really about manufacturing and the loss of jobs, which is something that's obviously really important to us here in the Midwest. You grew up in Buffalo?
Buffalo, New York, yep.
And was this something that was part of your childhood?
Well, my grandfather worked at Bethlehem Steel, which is a big plant there, and they went through big layoffs in my lifetime there. And, I did have an experience with this kind of thing with friends of mine at GM plants and Chevy plants and all that in Buffalo. So, yeah, I personally never worked in the plants, but I did do some interning and, you know, summer jobs and stuff like that in that world. So I kind of use that for my sense memory to bring it back to the stage in this play.
There's so much of this play that I think really breaks down actually how people get broken down by
right.
this process.
Oh, definitely, yeah. In fact, that's one of the big things about it, relationships that are torn apart by the situation that's going on in the factories. And this play is very good at that because it does deal with a lot of relationships.
And so I wonder how you were able to think about working with the actors with this incredible script that Lynn Nottage has. So basically it's set in two different time periods, but the main time period of the play is when this factory is in the process of layoffs, and
yeah.
pretty significant ones.
Right.
And there's a strike and the workers go out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of the ramifications of all of that.
Yeah, well, you know, in this particular situation, I employed some Chicago actors. And we tend to work in a collaborative way, at least I do. And so these actors brought so much to their own experiences to these characters, not only in the working environment, but the personal family, friendship environment. And it takes place in a bar. So everything happens in the bar that the world is dealing with in this situation. So in that sense, I think it was really a good relationship with my actors that was able to help me bring it to life.
So I used to be a labor reporter, and when I had to find union workers, I would always time it for when a shift was being
right,
done.
Exactly.
And then I would find the nearest bar to the factory,
exactly.
and then I would go hang out at the bar to talk to the workers.
And you know that's where a lot of them will be. And I think Lynn did a lot of research like that, and so her dialogue is probably taken a lot of it from those experiences that she had in her research.
So there's an interesting dynamic with the characters here, because the characters are white and black and Latino.
Right.
And the white and black characters are of this. It's really interesting to me because I think this is a play that's a lot more about class than race. Would you agree?
I wouldn't necessarily say more about that, but it is definitely about both of those things. Me personally, I think a lot of things are, you deal with race, even though it's not something that's the obvious thing that's said or done. But yes, I dealt with that in all those areas, you know, particularly like the union. It's harder for Cynthia, who's the black character, to be a part of the union. So she, her experience of being, you know, putting in management is more important, kind of because of her background as being an African-American woman dealing with getting into the union. In every union, every experience that you find with unions, people of color have a harder time breaking into that. I think it deals with that, even though it's not necessarily, you know, stated a lot in the play, but in our rehearsal process, we did dig deep into inside of what that might have been for her versus if Tracy, the other character, was able to have that management position. What would be the difference?
What's the difference between a white person and a black person?
Exactly.
Being able to leave the factory floor and go into management.
Right, yeah. But it does deal with class as well, but it also deals so many issues in this play. I mean, it's like everything you can think of. You know, the opioid crisis, drug addiction, depression, racism,
white
supremacy. All of those issues are into it. Immigrant situations, you know, even though she thinks he's an immigrant, but he was born here, you know. So those kind of things, talking about the Latino character. So it's very interesting because it does cover so many issues. You can't really pinpoint it. And I always like to say where I like when audiences are able to tap into different things. So it's not one thing that you're going to come and see and think about. You're going to think about all these different things. So there might be people that, you know, look at the Latino character more. Some people that might look at the woman that's an alcoholic more, if you have alcoholism in your family, things like that. So this play is really good for that.
I wonder if we can, I have actually a little clip.
Okay.
But I wonder if I could just play it for you.
And is there something you're not telling us?
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Come on, don't play games.
Are they going to be laying people off?
Whoa. Come again?
Are they?
Where'd you hear that bullshit?
Little bird. Answer me.
Look, there's been a little talk about trimming the overhead, but there always is.
Oh, we'll see about
that. I know what's important.
So I think there's a lot in there, right?
Right. Even in that short scene, there's so many things going on. Yeah.
I wonder how you approach that as a director when the economic thread is sort of the thread that ties all of this. But then from that, and oftentimes that's kind of a little bit how the world works, right? Money influences all of these other things, how we think about relationships, what happens in terms of all of these things you just mentioned about immigration or racism and all of those things.
Yeah.
When you're, how do you direct actors to think about juggling all of those things? Are they just really about inhabiting the role of these different characters?
It really is, yeah. You know, and it's not easy. I will say that. It depends on the actors that you have, for sure. And again, like I always pump up these Chicago actors because we are the greatest actors and directors in the world. And I have to say that. But yeah, those issues, we have issues that we discuss. We talk about our personal relationships or experiences. In that particular scene, Stan, the bartender at the place, has an experience there. He's older and he knows what's going on. And so in the background, he's like, he sees the writing on the wall. He's seen it before. And what's happened is at this time, Tracy has found out that they're looking for quote-unquote scabs. They're looking for people to cross the line and start working for less money, which is very relevant to what's going on today. You know, and even though we're talking about factories, you can talk about every union. A few years back, the NFL, for instance, went on strike, and they had these replacement players. And that's kind of the same kind of mentality that some of these owners of these big businesses employ. So in that scene, it's there's just beginning to find out that that's going on, and Cynthia hasn't really talked about it because she's in a
she's a new manager.
Yes, exactly.
She's just gotten off the floor, as we're talking about, right?
Exactly, and she's between a rock and a hard place there because her son works there. So, you know, she's in a sticky situation of how much she can reveal. So it's beginning to, we're beginning to find out and see the crux of the issue that's going on in the plant.
So I mentioned there's sort of two time frames here, but most of the play is set during the scene that we just heard. And is that kind of like, early, is that early 2000s?
2000.
So that's 2000. Mm-hmm. I wonder, I mean, when we think about that, that was actually almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, you know, man, time is flying, right?
And I wonder, when you think about the cycles of jobs and our economic cycles, but also when we look at manufacturing, like, this story isn't new.
Not really, no.
Of workers, of plants closing, and they are just
unions,
sort of introducing the whole concept of NAFTA. Like,
right?
They all have just heard of NAFTA.
That was a big deal.
And they're like, maybe they might send this factory to Mexico.
Right.
Do you think that even though that's in our recent history, and even though in some cases we kind of can see that repeating itself
and that
cycle playing out today, we forget?
Yeah, it's definitely cyclical. And I think that the younger generations think that these things are new, but this has been happening. I mean, if you look back in history, we did talk about that, how it does, you know, it's a cycle. It does happen depending on, you know, who's in office and what's going on in the, you know, stock market and all those different things. They determine a lot of these issues that happen with the major businesses.
I'm speaking with Ron O.J. Parson, who's the director of Sweat, which is on right now at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. Ron, to that point about who the president is, I think there are a lot of people who are thinking about our current president in office right now, how he was elected. There's a lot of conversation about even how sort of there was an anger that propelled him to office from workers like these characters that are in the play.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And I think that's something that, you know, Lynn didn't know what was going to happen and what the outcome would be and all that. And I think that's kind of what makes it relevant, I think, to today, because of what's in the news. I recently directed Radio Golf, which is also a play by August Wilson, which he wrote a while back. But actually now it's very, very relevant to today because of the climate and political climate. And I think the same thing here. We're finding some of these issues that are in the news every day. So when people come to the show and they see, they hear about the different union things that are going on, breaking into the union and people striking and people crossing the line, all this stuff is just so relevant to today.
I mentioned that I used to be a labor reporter, and I feel like I used to cover strikes, and I would talk to workers about the impact of what it was like. And I think this puts a incredible and really heartbreaking face on how people can, it can really destroy people's lives and their livelihood.
Right. You know, when I first got asked about the play, and I had seen it, and I came back home and there was a strike going on at one of the hotels, I can't remember, I had a whole new thought about that, those people that were out there striking. And I know they were on strike for, oh man, a long time, I think a year or so, maybe even more. And so in the play, one of the characters, Brucey, has been out 93 weeks. And you think about, wow, how long, and you see what that does to a human being and their spirit and their fighting. And, you know, so all of those things get put into play, you know, when you're working on it. So in this play, again, it has so much of that going on that you not only deal with that aspect of it, but you deal with the human spirit and what that can do and how it trickles down. All that's a part of the play. It's not just about what you hear and what you see on stage, but it's about what you feel. And I think if you can feel this play, those characters, the audience can really begin to feel what they're going through.
I wonder how you think this play has changed the way you think about our economy or the way that we think treat workers in this country.
I always had the thought of, you know, respect for workers, so from my experience. But I think what it did is it changed as a group when we were in the process a lot of, you know, different people talked, like I said, we talked about our experiences, and we were able to deal with a lot of those issues of, you know, maybe that's, you know, because always people would say, well, what do you want the audience to feel? And sometimes I don't get into that answer, but in this one, I think I want people to feel that we need to respect the worker, and we need to deal with, you know, these issues of class and race and racism, because that's a big issue in the play with, again, the Latino character who goes through a lot of, you know, situation. When there's a scene when he talks about his dad working and never even
his dad being a janitor in the factory.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And never being allowed to join the union.
Exactly.
People not seeing him. Right.
That's the issue that I'm talking about, too, where his character, he has that one moment, and I tried to get Steve Casillas, who's playing that, to blow that out, you know, just feel that. And he did a really, really good job. And so I think all of those issues were dealt with in rehearsal. That's what I call the Chicago way. I mean, we try to dig deep and make people feel these characters. So I think that we're doing that.
You can see Sweat at the Goodman Theater in Chicago until April 14th. Ron O.J. Parson is the director. Ron, thanks for being with me.
Hey, it's great. I love doing these interviews.
That does it for us today. You can always head to 21stshow.org for more information about the show, past shows, feedback. We love to hear from you, whether you have suggestions or comments. Head to 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.